Greetings again, everyone. On the way here, we were listening to the latest Pentagon briefing. I'm sure all the rest of you have been pretty much glued to your television sets or radios in the last week, so you're probably fairly well up to date on what has been occurring. It is sickening to sit here and realize that there has been spilled deliberately into the Gulf over there a lake of oil about twice the size of Lake Palestine. Apparently some 30, probably close to 40 miles long and about eight miles wide by now, that is being deliberately pumped into the Gulf or leaked into the Gulf by the Iraqi forces, who have punctured holes in huge supertankers and are actually pumping it in from huge storage tanks ashore. So who knows how many hundreds of thousands of dolphins, fish, seabirds, and every other type of marine life, including even the bacterial life on the sands of that area, are going to die over the years to come. This may be something which will last for a decade or longer in the long run, something which is really global in its impact because it is an environmental catastrophe of unparalleled proportions in the history of the world, so far as we know, and certainly in the history of the world that could be man-caused, perhaps on an order of something like the explosion of Krakatoa, or some of the most gigantic earthquakes, or some other so-called natural disaster. Some hours ago, the Iraqis set fire to that oil, and where it is thickest, of course, it burns, although slowly, because the flash point of crude is very, very high, much higher than for, as you might think, refined products. Unfortunately, the oil is drifting over toward Iran. I wonder what the final analysis is going to be from all of the people that I am tempted to call peaceniks, perhaps because of my recollection of the Vietnam War, of all the people around the world who are calling George Bush the butcher of Panama, the entire global community who looks at a man who is apparently playing out a tragedy in the same way that Adolf Hitler did. A little more on that later on. Just before we came over here, I learned that one dozen fighters and one dozen transport aircraft have landed in Iran, apparently defected. I now have no doubt, when I look at that and appraise it, that what we had heard earlier from a Soviet official, that Saddam Hussein had allegedly ordered the execution of two of his top generals, the one over his air defenses and the one over his air force, has in fact been carried out. I would imagine the reason for these defections of taking tens of millions of dollars of expensive Russian-built aircraft and landing them on Iranian airports is because Saddam Hussein shot their general. That's my opinion. Also, in the last 24 hours, three MiG-23 floggers have been shot down by F-15s. Round-the-clock bombing raids continues. 10 Iraqi soldiers came across and surrendered. You may have heard the Saudi Arabians say this morning that we were very happy to receive them, and they seem to be very happy to be here. The Republican Guard's positions are under constant bombing attack, and for the first time in history, you learn that U.S. submarines, or one submarine, had launched six Tomahawk cruise missiles while submerged. Well, who is Saddam Hussein? Is he crazy? Is he cunning? Can you really liken him to Adolf Hitler? Let me recommend a book to you that has just now hit the newsstands within the last week. Benny Sharp came to the office the other day with this one. I took a look at it, talked to him about it, and went right down to B. Dalton's bookstore and bought one for myself. And since that time, I've been reading it and marking it up. It's called Saddam Hussein and the Crisis in the Gulf by a couple of ladies who are, I think, on the Time Life staff. It is historical, biographical, current, has a great deal of useful information. Some quotations I want to go through with you for a few moments, because all dictators are essentially alike. There's a scripture I want to turn to set this up a little bit, that we've referred to time and again, found in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. And it has to do, actually, with state worship and with the worship of military despots, military leaders or dictators, and in fact, the subjugation of individual initiative, individual personal decisions, decision-making, individual or personal responsibility into the leader of the state who embodies that state as if it is a living organism where the leader and the state become confused and become as one. You all very well remember perhaps the great Nuremberg rallies and some of the other great Nazi torchlight parades in which some of those who adulated Adolf Hitler were saying, Deutschland ist Hitler, Hitler ist Deutschland. They were one and the same. Hitler is Germany, Germany is Hitler, the will of Hitler is the will of the Deutsche Volk, and so on. And so these Deutsche Volk, whom Hitler continually praised and talked of their Aryan superiority, were the people whom he said when he was near death, his suicide in his Führer bunker in the eastern portions of Berlin had, quote, betrayed him, end quote, and who were not worthy of him. In a moment, a little more about that, but first this scripture. In Revelation, the 13th chapter, he sees this beast in verse 2 like a leopard, whose feet are as the feet of a bear. It had the most powerful constituencies of all of the four beasts of Daniel 7, which represents all of the great four world-ruling empires. The mouth is the mouth of a lion, and the dragon, Satan the devil, as you read in Revelation 12:9, gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I think when you look at Adolf Hitler's record, or the record of Genghis Khan, or the record of Attila the Hun, or Joseph Stalin, or Pol Pot, or other despots or dictators who have actually butchered to death, or gassed to death, or burnt to death, or killed otherwise hundreds of thousands or even millions of human beings. The only way I've ever been able to cope with that kind of heartlessness and merciless brutality is utterly inhuman to me, and has always been something that to me has been tempting to assign to total demon possession or demonic influence, if not satanic possession or satanic influence. I've never been able to really understand a serial killer or someone who would torture another human being aside from some evil spirit influencing a human mind. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. So this is actually devil worship, or worship of the devil. And they worshiped the beast. Now this is a man, but at once it is a dictator and the military organization, and therefore the state or the coalition of states that he represents, saying, who is like unto the beast? In other words, he's number one. He is the best, the biggest, the most powerful. Who is more glorious? Who is more intelligent? Now, as we will read here in a few moments from some of the excerpts I have for you to whet your appetite about this book, when you go to Iraq, you enter into a Big Brother society. The minute you get out of the airport, you see nothing but Saddam. Gigantic 2-, 3-, 4-story pictures of the man are everywhere, smiling down on you. Saddam this and Saddam that. The name Saddam, as you probably now know from listening to the media, means one who confronts or to confront. And so they worship the beast, and they say, who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him? So they adore war making. They exult in military capability. It delights them to believe in a leader who has the power to cause his neighbors to tremble in fear, to roll over them with tanks, crushing them like the Chinese did in Tiananmen Square. Who is this man? He is megalomaniacal. He is imbued with a lust for personal power. He is also fearful. He's riddled with fear. He's almost in terror. But I am describing now all dictators. All dictators are like this. They are megalomaniacal, imbued with a lust for personal power, fearful to the point of paranoia. They're afraid that everyone is plotting against them. They trust no one, even their closest family members, but inevitably they will try to consolidate their power with their near and distant kin and their allegedly most trusted friends, because they're the only people they can trust at least part way, and them they don't trust altogether. They like to keep an eye on them. Cite a case or two out of recent history. We have known that when some of the Organization of African States have held their meetings here or there around the nation, or around the continent, I should say, that some of the neo-African despots in some tiny nations, which have, of course, traditionally disregarded the ancient old guns versus butter issue and promptly set out to rape and pillage the nation to order some Mirage Mystère jets to intimidate their neighbors, have, when they have gone to these meetings in maybe their own 747, taken practically their entire top military command, most of their family members, and practically anybody who had any power or authority in the entire nation along with them, because they don't dare leave them at home while they're gone. You can see what I'm leading to, for fear of an overthrow. Usually, these men have in the past been rather poorly educated. You cannot cite among them a single intellectual. Not Stalin, not Hitler, not Pol Pot, not Genghis Khan, not Attila the Hun, and not Saddam Hussein. Vulgar in their tastes, usually. Often poorly educated, as I said, non-intellectuals with twisted historical and sociological viewpoints, narcissistic, but at the same time, listen to this, generous and charismatic. So let me just sum it up by saying dictators can be charming. I want to give you a few quotations out of this book, and I'll try to hurry along with it. There are several, and there are some of them are fairly lengthy, and I'll try to be brief, but it's just fascinating material. Saddam Hussein loves The Godfather. It's his favorite movie, one he has seen many times. I've never seen it, and never darkened the door of a theater and go near it, because that kind of stuff just doesn't appeal to me, but that's just the difference. Personal choice. He's especially fascinated by somebody called Don Corleone, a poor boy made good, whose respect for family is exceeded only by his passion for power. The iron-willed character of the Don may be perhaps the most telling model for the enigmatic figure that rules Iraq. Both come from dirt-poor peasant villages, both sustain their authority by violence, and for both, family is the key to power. Family is everything, or almost everything, because the Saddam, like the Godfather, ultimately trusts no one, not even his next of kin. For both calculation and discipline, loyalty and ruthlessness are the measure of a man's character. Skipping along to Saddam Hussein was born 53 years ago, April 28, 1937, to a miserably poor, landless peasant family in the village of Al-Ahuya, near the town of Takrit on the Tigris River, 100 miles north of Baghdad. Although Muslims generally do not share the Western custom of celebrating birthdays, when Saddam came to power, he made his birthday a national holiday. Skip over a few pages from that. Having started elementary school when he went to live with an uncle in Baghdad after he finally left a stepfather's care, his original father either deserted his mother, ran off with another woman, or simply left or was kicked out. That's kind of not settled in the biographical information here. But apparently when he was a boy, his stepfather sent him out to steal chickens to keep the family going, goats and chickens. Having started elementary school when he went to live with Kairala, Saddam was 16 when he finished intermediary school, roughly the equivalent of American junior high school. Like his uncle, he wanted to become an army officer, but his poor grades kept him out of the prestigious Baghdad Military Academy. Of the generation of Arab leaders who took power in the military coups of the 50s and 60s, only Saddam Hussein had no army experience. In 1976, he would correct that deficiency by getting himself appointed lieutenant general. He went straight from civilian to lieutenant general, a rank equal to the chief of staff. When he became president in 1979, he would promote himself to field marshal and would insist on personally directing the war against Iran. Hitler, of course, was a corporal, and he personally gave orders to direct the war here and there and elsewhere, and, of course, was the ultimate disaster for the German people, the Russians, and a lot of other people as a result of Hitler's bungling. And we can be thankful he bungled, or it might have been even more difficult to defeat him. A little later on, Saddam soon found himself swept up in a world of political intrigue whose seductions were far more compelling than the tedium of schoolwork. In 1956, he participated in an abortive coup against the Baghdad monarchy, and the next year, at the age of 20, he joined the Ba'ath Party, one of several radical nationalist organizations that had spread throughout the Arab world. But at that time, the Ba'ath in Iraq were a tiny and relatively powerless band of about 300 members. Think about that. And think back to how Hitler came to power and how many dictators have come to power with a tiny cadre of people who were very loyal to them. In 1958, a non-Ba'athist group of nationalist army officers led by General Abdul Karim Qasim succeeded in overthrowing King Faisal II. The fall of the monarchy intensified plotting among Iraq's rival dissident factions. A year after Qasim's coup, the Ba'ath tried to seize power by machine gunning Qasim's car in broad daylight. Saddam, whose name translates as one who confronts, was a member of the hit team. Allegedly, he killed his first man when he was 15. He went from stealing chickens and goats to killing people and was standing there with a machine gun trying to kill the president of his country by the time he was in his early 20s. He'd already proven his mettle, or in the jargon of the American underworld, has made his bones by murdering a communist supporter of Qasim in Tikrit. The communists were the Ba'ath's fierce rivals. In fact, the man he killed was his brother-in-law. A little later on, from Syria, Saddam went to Cairo, where he would spend the next 4 years. The stay in Egypt was to be only extended experience in another country. Supported by an Egyptian government stipend, he resumed political activities, finally finishing high school at the age of 24. In Cairo, he was arrested twice. The first arrest occurred when he threatened to kill a fellow Iraqi student over political differences, and the second when he chased a fellow Ba'athist student through the streets of Cairo with a knife, trying to kill him. He was, of course, let go on both occasions a little later on. Didn't spend long in jail in either two. In Cairo, Saddam married his uncle Khairallah's daughter, Saida, in 1963. His studies in Egypt ended abruptly in February when Ba'athist army officers and a group of Arab nationalist officers succeeded in ousting and killing General Qasim, a figure of considerable popularity. Skipping down a few paragraphs, many people refused in Iraq to believe that Qasim was dead. The rumors were he'd gone into hiding. The Iraqi television decided to prove it to them. And so night after night, they displayed his bullet-ridden body on television. As Samer al-Khalil, in his excellent book, Republic of War, tells it, and I quote, "The body was propped upon a chair in the studio. A soldier would saunter around handling its parts. The camera would cut to scenes of devastation at the Ministry of Defense where Qasim had made his last stand. There on location, it lingered on the mutilated corpses of Qasim's entourage, of whom there were several, al-Mawadi, Wasi Tahir, and others. Back to the studio and close-ups now, the entry and exit points of each bullet hole. The whole macabre sequence closes with a scene that must forever remain etched on the memory of all those who saw it. The soldier grabs the lolling head by the hair, comes up close, and spits full into the face of it." Marvelous people, aren't they, these Iraqis? Would you say that their mentality is a little bit different from ours? Saddam was elated. He hurried back to Baghdad to assume his part in the revolution. He was 26 years old. Saddam quickly found his place in the new regime. He became an interrogator and torturer in the Qasr al-Nihaya, or the Palace of the End, so called because it was where King Faisal and his family were gunned down in 1958, and under it, the palace, that is, there was a torture chamber. Few in the West are aware of Saddam's activities there, but in Iraq, the arrested and accused of plotting against the Ba'ath is told of his own torture. He said, "My arms and legs were bound by rope. I was hung on the rope to a hook on the ceiling and repeatedly beaten with rubber hoses filled with stones." He managed to survive, but others were not quite so lucky. Finally, a grisly discovery was made in 1963 by the army. In the cellars of the Al-Nihya Palace, according to Hanna Batatu, whose account is based on official government sources, were found all sorts of loathsome instruments, including electric wires with pincers, pointed iron stakes on which prisoners were made to sit, and a machine which still bore traces of chopped-off fingers. Small heaps of blooded clothing were scattered about, and there were pools of blood on the floor and stains on the walls. Saddam was in charge. He, later on, was imprisoned again. And I won't go into all of that, but there was a split in the party of 1963. Upon his escape from prison, he quickly set about building the party's internal security apparatus, or Jihaz Hanin, instrument of yearning. Those deemed enemies of the party were to be killed, unfriendly factions intimidated. Saddam's reputation as an architect of terror grew. 2 years later, on July 30th, 1968, Saddam and his Ba'athist comrades succeeded in seizing and holding state power. Bakr became president and commander-in-chief in addition to his duties as secretary general of the Ba'ath Party and chairman of its Revolutionary Command Council. Saddam was made deputy chairman of the council in charge of internal security, and internal security invariably means in any nation like this, any totalitarian state, the secret police, people who spy on people, people who keep the nation in subjugation to its leader. He quickly moved to strengthen his control and expand his base of power within the party. The security services granted hundreds of graduated hundreds of Saddam's men from their secret training schools, among them several of his half-brothers, Barzan, Sabawi, and Rahman. Another graduate, his cousin Ali Hassan al-Mayyid, would earn notoriety years later for his genocidal suppression of the Kurds during the Iraq-Iran War and his leading invasion in the role of the invasion of Kuwait. Another graduate was Arshad Yassin, his cousin and brother-in-law, whom the world would come to know as the bodyguard who repeatedly stroked the head of Stuart Lockwood, the young British guest, as Saddam tried to get him to talk about milk and cornflakes. We all saw that on television a few months ago. Saddam was 31. His penchant for asserting his authority by title, today he holds 6, was evident even then. He insisted on being called Mr. Deputy. Nobody else in Iraq had ever been Mr. Deputy. It was his title alone. The hallmarks of the new regime soon became apparent. Barely 3 months after the coup, the regime announced on October 9, 1968, that it had smashed a major Zionist spy ring. Fifth columnists were denounced before crowds of tens of thousands. On January 5, 1969, 17 spies, in quote, went on trial. 14 were hung, 11 of whom were Jewish, their bodies left to dangle before crowds of hundreds of thousands in Baghdad's Liberation Square. Some way to liberate. Even the Egyptian newspaper Al-Aram condemned the spectacle and said the hanging of 14 people in the public square is certainly not a heartwarming sight, nor is the occasion for organizing a festival. Radio Baghdad scoffed at the international condemnation and said, "We hang spies, but the Jews crucified Christ." Over the next year and a half, a tapestry of alleged treason was unraveled, providing a steady spectacle of denunciation and execution. The victims were no longer primarily Jews. Very soon they were mostly Muslims. And so the Ba'ath began their rule, with Saddam, of course, now in charge, with an inauguration of blood. Skip over a few pages to a couple of other quick quotes. Saddam and his closest colleagues became better known for their vulgarity, their clannish-like mafia stories, like extreme clannishness and brutality or legion inside Iraq, but rarely have they been told beyond their borders. As a matter of fact, Saddam took a second wife. He had the guy move out of his way to allow that to happen, and then later on promoted him to become the director of an airline company in thanks for providing Saddam with his second wife. After the marriage, a member of the Shahbandar clan told Farouk, his wife, in what he thought was the intimacy of their own bedroom, that Samira, his second wife, was not a real Shahbandar, because it explains in here, without going into it, that Saddam was trying to up his social standing by marrying into a very high-standing family. And in fact, she was not a real Shahbandar. Her father, he explained, had simply taken the family name. Farouk was unaware the bedroom was bugged. He and his wife were arrested and are still in prison. If they are alive, they were sentenced to life imprisonment for sharing that little conversation in their own bedroom. Recently, a General Omar al-Hazza boasted to a woman friend while visiting her home that he had once slept with Saddam's mother. The woman's home was wired. When Saddam acquired the tape recording, he called a conclave of the Takridi clan and played it for them. According to one eyewitness, he openly wept, crying, "What do you expect me to do with a man like that?" The response was predictable. Hazza and his son, not just Hazza, but his son, an officer in the Presidential Guard, were both executed. Their homes were bulldozed and reduced to rubble. The woman was executed and hanged. All she'd done is listen to it. Nice man. Iraq is run as a private preserve of Saddam and his inner clique. He distributes wealth, assigning sectors to his family and other close associates to control and to milk. His cousin and son-in-law, Hussein Kamal al-Mayyid, is responsible for all military purchases. I won't go into this, but it shows how he bought some of the Chinese Scuds. He personally pocketed $60 million in Swiss bank accounts. Uday is his oldest son. His talents as a businessman, skipping over the page, are perhaps matched only by his capacity for violence. His father's valet was invited to a party. Uday didn't like him. There was something he had done that Uday didn't like. He arrived at the party with his bodyguards, pushed other people aside, and it was at a party for Susi Mubarak, the wife of the president of Egypt, who saw this in horror when Saddam's son had a heavy club and walked up to this guy whose name was Gagio and bludgeoned him to death in front of the startled guests. Nice people. The Sunday Times of London reported that one of his elite Republican guards, one of the generals, was about to be dismissed because he had incurred Saddam's wrath. 2 months later, it was reported he had died in a helicopter crash. When Saddam travels abroad, which is infrequently and almost always to other Arab countries, this obviously prior to now, he'll never travel abroad again, probably, he makes sure to take his own food and food taster. He is said to take his own chair to prevent an enemy from embedding a poisonous tack or needle in the cushion. Before he sits down, a trusted guard brings in the chair, and as soon as the session is over and he rises, the aide removes it. They take it wherever he goes on his own airplane. At the Arab Cooperation Council summit in February 1990, the lights went out briefly, power failure. According to Arab sources, Saddam, fearing an assassination attempt, dove under the table for cover. Of the four heads of state present, he was the only one to hit the floor. Saddam's reluctance to confess his rough-hewn peasant origins has prompted him to claim the noblest lineage. I find that fascinating, how when people of perhaps doubtful parentage come to power, other people around them have got to try to manufacture some different type of lineage, perhaps even finding significance in the meaning of their name. And even though one might suspect they're either Lithuanian or perhaps South African, they decide to turn them into a Jew, if that's what they want to do, or turn them into something else. I've seen cases of that recently. Maybe you know what I'm talking about, maybe you don't. Saddam's reluctance to confess his rough-hewn peasant origins has prompted him to claim the noblest lineage. He has presented a family tree to the Iraqi public. It traces his roots to the Prophet Muhammad. Saddam Hussein has said the glory of the Arabs stems from the glory of Iraq. Throughout history, whenever Iraq became mighty and flourished, so did the Arab nation. This is why we are striving to make Iraq mighty, formidable, able, and developed. The means to be used are graphically spelled out in the words of al-Hajjadi, the governor of what is now Iraq in the 7th century A.D., whose reign is described by Marshall Hogsden in his book, The Venture of Islam, as one of frank terror. The following lines are known to every Iraqi schoolchild. Quote, I see heads before me that are ripe and ready for the plucking, and I am the one to pluck them. I see blood glistening between the turbans and the beards. If you want to read a book, it sometimes will make you sick to your stomach, bits and pieces of fingers lying around torture chambers. It's a book about a nice guy named Saddam Hussein. It's all about oil. Saddam Hussein, petty thief, megalomaniac, coward, murderer, a torturer, a terrorist, an effrontery to all of mankind, an environmental terrorist who kills birds, seals, dolphins, and fish in a spate of suicidal wrath. Like a demonic spirit, this sniveling jackal murders people or creatures with equal alacrity and watches in glee, as his own bodyguard testified the other night on 60 Minutes, as human beings who have fallen in his disfavor were slowly lowered into baths of acid and died. Hitler was a student of Wagnerian opera. I don't know if you've ever gone to an opera. Probably most of you have not. Wagnerian operas are said to be some of the heaviest for a lot of people who don't particularly like Wagner's style of music. One of his most famous, or perhaps I should say infamous, well, there are some that are certainly more cherished than this by those who like to go to operas, but one of the most famous is called Götterdämmerung, and that means basically the evening or the night of the gods, meaning sundown or the final fate of the gods, so to speak. Let me just read to you right quickly about this favorite opera of Adolf Hitler, who went to it over and over and over again, especially in Vienna, which for a pretty significant time of Wagner's life was his place of writing and producing some of his operas. Various political things you can read about in his life he got into. He would go to Switzerland or to France or other places from time to time to escape them. Götterdämmerung, the twilight or gathering nightfall of the gods, the title of Wagner's closing opera in the Nibelung cycle of dramas, first produced at the Bayreuth Festival 11 August 1876 and in the United States at New York on 25th January 1888. The subject of the opera is what is called in Scandinavian mythology the Ragnarok, or the end of the world. This was brought about largely by the admission of, and all of this from now on is, of course, fable, of Loki, L-O-K-E, the god of evil and mischief, into Asgard, the abode of the gods. It was through Loki that Baldur, the bright and good god, was slain and flung down into the abodes of Hel, H-E-L, goddess of death. Confusion throughout the universe is the consequence. The sun and moon are swallowed by giants. Continuous winters rage without an intervening summer. The earth trembles in the throes of earthquakes. This, no doubt, brought about by all sorts of viols, timpanis, and huge drum rolls, and the singing of tenors and basses and sopranos, big fat women warbling at the top of their lungs, wearing all kinds of weird costumes, dancing around the stage with the lights flashing and smoke bubbling up, and so on in an opera. Mountains topple down with a crash. Fenrir breaks its chains and fetters. The Midgard serpent writhes to get free. The ship Naglfar, built of the fingernails of dead men, passes over the sea, filled with giants of the frost and mountain. Loki leads the hosts of hell and bursts upon the scene. That's probably somebody singing like mad, comes dancing out in the body stocking with the drums rolling and all of that. The powers of evil rush to the battlefield Vigrid, while Heimdall blows his Jarlhorn. Odin seeks the giants for advice, and other gods as well as heroes of Valhall arm themselves and sally forth, and the battle begins. While the fight is still raging, the immortal god Surt flings light and flame over all the world, and the earth, reduced to ashes, sinks beneath the watery waste. And that's the end of Götterdämmerung, Hitler's favorite opera. Historians have said that Hitler, once he saw the war going against him, was actually acting out his own Götterdämmerung from his Hitler bunker deep beneath, several stories beneath, buildings by the Chancellery in East Berlin, where he had many millions of dollars, an air-conditioned hideout built for himself. Have you seen lately on television the many stories, I think seven stories underground, with rubber beneath it to absorb shocks of large bombs and so on, all air-conditioned and stocked and everything in there? Saddam Hussein is hiding out in his bunker and giving orders to dump millions, hundreds of millions of gallons of oil into the Persian Gulf. This is a man who is playing out his Götterdämmerung. Now, how do you understand a human mind who at once, as Adolf Hitler did, can sign an executive order telling the people who were there at his wolf's lair or his alpine retreat to go and to begin to butcher Europe's Jews and to gas them to death, and moments after signing it, stoop down, and we actually have this on motion picture with sound, and caressed the ear of his favorite German shepherd dog and patted him and said, "Oh my, you feel like you're a little bit losing weight. I see I've been neglecting you lately." Isn't that unbelievable? Felt for his dog, and he had just signed 6 million Jews' death warrant. Adolf Hitler's speeches, his parades through the cities, fainting women, mesmerized men, strutting parades, the Nazi salute, frenzied demonstrations of love and support, are exactly what we see here in Revelation 13. And all of those people, women, children alike, little schoolboys and girls that we've talked about being herded out of their classrooms into the streets of Baghdad to chirp and scream out epithets against you and me and all Americans who are supposed to be called the great Satan, and in absolute glee talking about Saddam. In recent days and hours and minutes before coming in here, there were more Scud attacks on Tel Aviv, Haifa, and in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Just moments before coming here, I was watching again the Patriot missiles taking off. Some of them apparently got through. Some have intercepted them, but then both fall upon areas, and perhaps we'll hear of more deaths or injuries when we go home after church services. But it is hard to imagine how people can allow themselves to be completely overcome by a dictator. Now let me tell you that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is not a dictator. God is not a dictator in the human sense. And let me point out for you the vast difference between the two. Over in Zechariah 7, in Zechariah the 7th chapter, I want to just turn to this because it's one of many scriptures like it in the Bible. The word of the Eternal came unto Zechariah, saying, verse 9, "Thus says the Eternal of hosts, saying, execute true judgment. Now, judgment requires a decision. Judgment requires collection of data or of facts, of information. And then it requires a body of men, or one or two or three, four men, or whatever, to make a decision. Execute true judgment and show mercy and compassions every man to his brother. And oppress not the widow, nor the fatherless, the stranger, nor the poor. And let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. That's what God said to Israel anciently. But they refused to hearken, and pulled away the shoulder, and stopped their ears that they should not hear. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear the law, and the words which the Eternal of Hosts has sent in his spirit, or by his spirit, by the former prophets. Therefore came a great wrath, talking about the captivity of 70 years in Babylon by the Jews. A great wrath from the Eternal of Hosts. Therefore it came to pass that as he cried, and they would not hear, so they cried, and I would not hear, said the Eternal of Hosts. But I scattered them with a whirlwind among all the nations whom they knew not. Thus the land was desolate after them, that no man passed through nor returned, for they laid the pleasant land desolate. The Russians said recently that Saddam Hussein, and he may have done it personally because he enjoys that, and there are eyewitnesses who testify that he has actually shot people in the face with their hands tied behind their back and lowered them into baths of acid, and was for years a torturer beneath that palace, administering torture that we won't talk about to who knows how many tens, dozens, or hundreds of people. So I do not doubt the Russian report that Saddam, infuriated over the inadequacy of his air force and his air defenses, has either personally shot or ordered to be shot two of his leading generals. I personally would link the defection of about two dozen aircraft to Iran with that event. And of course, that does give me some hope that perhaps eventually a lot of these people would turn on him and come forward. But you've got to remember, as it says in the news, that in front of them they got a minefield, and in back of them are the Imperial Guards. It just got to be at that point in time where the Imperial Guards can't do anything about it. Maybe they'll come out and surrender. God's Word tells us that God is love. But the kind of love that that implies is far different than the kind of love that Hitler had for his dog, or Saddam Hussein for his second, third, or fourth wife, or his mistress, or his love of torture, or his love, as he might define it, toward a pet or someone else. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. I have had experience in my lifetime with the opposite of practically all of these attributes of character. But let me remind you as you're turning there that God says that we are to overcome and to, quote, grow in not just grace and knowledge, but in grace and the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That's a particular kind of knowledge that Jesus Christ accumulated, because it said he learned by the things which he suffered. We are told, to those that overcome will I grant to sit with me in my throne. A throne is an executive position. It requires decision making at the absolute highest level. If someone sits with Christ in his throne, even as he told the disciples that they would inherit the 12 thrones of Israel, judging the 12 tribes of Israel, and judges render decisions based upon data or a collection of facts. So how do you prepare to be a judge, a prince, a king, a ruler, a leader? Certainly the pattern that we're talking about today, and the pattern in society generally, whether it's the neighborhood bully that we all remembered when we were children playing marbles after school, whether it was someone in a fraternity or sorority, whether it was someone in a religious institution or a military institution or what have you, are not the type of leader or ruler that Jesus Christ of Nazareth wants us to be, or that he was. In the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charitable love, that is an outgoing love of concern for the one being loved, not an ingrown, incoming love of selfishness, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so I could remove mountains, and how many of us would like to have so much faith that people are just healed instantly of terminal cancer, that we could go empty hospitals, literally move mountains. I'd like to move a mountain right now right over Saddam Hussein's palace, or move a mountain of sand over that oil spill and soak it up. And you had that kind of faith, yet you still didn't have this kind of charitable love. You are nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, now that is such an extreme one cannot imagine it, and have not charity, it profits me nothing. What kind of love is he talking about? This kind of love suffers long. So there is no breaking point. We're all familiar with the statement, that did it. Now that one, that did it there. Now that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I've taken it up to this point in time, but that word right there, now that action, that did it. So everybody says, and this is just something we've learned in society, we've gone to movies and read literature, and it's kind of dramatic, and we think, now's the time to spring that on her, or him, or whatever. I'm going to say, that did it. And they'll really think I'm about to go to Fifth City, you know, really get mad and do something absolutely dramatic. Charity suffers long and is kind. Charity does not envy. Charity vaunts not itself. That kind of love doesn't put huge three-story billboards with your picture on it everywhere. It doesn't call ministers on the carpet for failing to mention the name of the leader at least 26 times in every sermon. It does not vaunt itself. It doesn't stand up there and boast of its accomplishments and achievements and tell everybody what a great guy you are. Is not puffed up. When you see these characters swaggering around like this with their arms up in the air with these funny-looking helmets and half of them out of step to some band in Iraq with Saddam Hussein standing out there with his little tam on, does it make you think about the exact opposite of these qualities? Is Saddam puffed up? Now, lately he's gone to praying. Can you imagine a man that is guilty of the grisly tortures and the murders up close, shooting people while he's looking at them right in the face with their arms tied behind their back? They can, on the other hand, get on a Persian prayer rug and claim to be praying to God. It just boggles your mind. That's why I say it's got to be something to do with demoniacal influence or with the influence of Satan, the devil himself. Does not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own or its own way or its own thing, always looking out for number one, pursuing the personal bank account, personal aggrandizement, personal advantage. Is not easily provoked. Now, Saddam can't take a joke. I guess I didn't read the part. There are many others in here you will read, but if you do get the book, you will read of a time when many of his officers were gathered around. And they were just in a private party, and somebody told a few jokes about Saddam. Everybody enjoyed it royally, but the place was bugged. And they were all executed. You remember when Barbara Walters interviewed him before all of this got started, and they replayed it sometime recently, I think on 60 Minutes. And she asked him about the allegations of having executed some of his own officers with his own pistol, of course, of which he was guilty. He really didn't answer her question, but he answered it with a question by saying, well, what happens in your country if somebody speaks evil of your president? And Barbara Walters said, well, they give him his own television show. Remember that? Did you see that program? Now, what does that tell you about this 26-year-old graduate of high school, of what he knows about our society, about the way our government works, about the way George Bush is elected, about the checks and balances on George Bush, about the constraints that he is under to go to Congress as he did to get a slightly majority decision to even give him presidential power to do what he's done? It tells you that the man is absolutely ignorant of our nation. He has miscalculated from day one. But unfortunately, we fed this animal the wrong signals. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly said within days of Saddam's attack into Kuwait to our Congress, we have no commitments to Kuwait. And that was in response. Spy satellite information that at least 100,000 of his troops were massed on the Kuwaiti border. Saddam knew that. He heard that. He can get it on American television, get it through the diplomatic communication from his own embassy, who heard it immediately. So we fed him all the wrong signals, and we told this jackal that the carcass was out there ripe for the plucking. He thought we would do exactly what the world did when we went into Grenada or Panama. Nothing. How wrong he was, and how wrong we were to do business with him. For over 70 American firms, including Westinghouse and Caterpillar, I told you last week, to beat a path to his door, for West Germans and Swiss and French and Italians and British and American firms to sell him technology, and even as late as just barely before the embargo came crashing down, but after the invasion of Kuwait, many American firms were shipping him, smuggling to him, high-tech mainframe computers camouflaged as washing machine parts and refrigerators. There are people in our society, West German, Italian, British, doesn't matter what society, any society, who, as we used to say, would sell their own mother for a buck. It does not matter to them at all about the waste of human life or the entire ecological disaster going on over there, as long as they, and how stupid it seems, can have their money so that they can have their home in Europe. What's Europe going to look like, for pity's sake, after this is all over? But that is their short-sighted, ridiculous desire and lust to just make money. Is not easily provoked, verse 5, thinketh no evil, does not automatically think that there is something evil in someone else's demeanor or discussion. Rejoices not in sin or iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Abusers were nearly always themselves abused. This is something that has come out of psychology in the last decade or so, and is being very widely publicized in the United States because of our sensational court cases of recent years of child abuse all over the United States, and especially daycare centers, and you know of all this sensationalism. And then the revelation that incest and all sorts of abuse, not only of just sadomasochistic abuse of beating children sometimes half to death or killing them, but also sexual abuse, is far more widespread than people ever wanted to admit it really was. Saddam, if you want to be charitable, was an abused child. He was soundly cursed by a stepfather, sent out into the streets of a poverty-stricken little village that had only one paved road, lived in an absolute hovel where they burnt cow chips for fuel. As a child, he was beaten. He was kicked. He was cursed. He was not loved. He did not have the kind of solace and the care that we give our children. So from the time he was a baby boy, he was being twisted and turned into the monster he has presently become. Why do you suppose that the Palestinians, who have been not allowed to assimilate into the various populations of the nations to which they have gone as refugees following the 1967 Jew-Arab War, and that includes Jordan, the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, down in Egypt, and especially over in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, where there are large contingents of Palestinians, but especially the people living inside East Jerusalem and the West Bank today, some of whom have been interviewed in the last couple of days, and they are absolutely ecstatic. They are applauding Saddam Hussein. They are delighted, as one woman I heard say today out of her automobile, to hear about these Scud missiles coming crashing down on Tel Aviv. Now, you know, humanly, it makes you wish that some of them would come crashing down where these people live, but of course we don't really want to feel that way, and I think sometimes we find our patriotism or our Americanism and our Christianity becoming a little bit blurred. It's easy to do that. We need to pray to God to make sure they don't become totally blurred and we keep our perspective in this, because I have to pray to God to say, I'm sorry, Father, I am an American, and sometimes I react like an American before I catch myself and say, now, how would Christ react to this situation? But there are millions of such brutes that have been created. There are hundreds of thousands of them in our society, but our society does not allow for the emergence of a dictator. But in all of these various Arab states and many other third world states, all up and down the length and breadth of Africa, all over Southeast Asia, in China, in Russia, and elsewhere, these individuals who have been so brutalized and abused can emerge eventually as a figure just like Saddam Hussein. I want to skip over a little bit now to Mark the 8th chapter and verse 14. Mark 8 and verse 14. Jesus Christ of Nazareth was on many occasions moved with compassion. You see, if that's what I want, or is that Matthew? I'm sorry, did I say Mark? I meant Matthew, excuse me. I'm going to come back to Mark in a moment. Matthew 8:15. I saw that before I got my glasses on. Matthew 8 and verse 15. How many of you have heard mother-in-law jokes? I've heard a lot of them. Apparently Jesus had not. I doubt that he even enjoyed them if he did. It says here in the 8th chapter of the book of Matthew, not Mark, and in verse 14, when Jesus was come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's, that's Peter's wife's mother, laid sick of a fever. And he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and ministered unto them. Now there are many occasions, including if you'll go back to verse 2, there was a leper that came and worshipped him and said, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. And I want you to think about this for a moment, because lepers traditionally, in nations like that, had to sound out an alarm as they walked down the street. And they had to say, leper, leper. And then people would get out of their way and give them very wide berths. Jesus touched him. And you didn't do that to a leper. Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be thou clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said unto him, see that you tell no man, but go your way. Amazing examples. Look at all of this. First of all, he had compassion. Secondly, he had no fear. He wasn't worried about pins and needles with poison on them in his cushion, or taking a food taster with him wherever he went to make sure they took the first sip or the first bite, which Saddam Hussein does. He had compassion for this poor, disfigured man with this terrible, sickening disease who probably stank to the heavens, and portions of his flesh were rotting, and he reached out and touched him, and the man became clean. Next point, he didn't want anybody to know about it. But you and I would want someone to know about it. Isn't it amazing? I love to publish. I guess I want to do it, hopefully for an unselfish purpose. When we get a letter that comes in of someone who has been miraculously healed, we like to share that, and we hope that our motives are pure, and our motives are because it would encourage other people. Not to make us great or to say, look what we did, our prayers did it, because it could be anybody's prayers. Some little widow lady up in Michigan could have been on her knees praying when someone was healed. But Jesus said, see that you don't tell anybody about this. Go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came the centurion saying, my servant lies at home, sick of the palsy, and grievously tormented, and gave the example of how a man under his authority did what he was told in verse 9. And Jesus marveled and said, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, verse 10, in all of Israel. There are many other examples in this same chapter in verse 16. When even was come, they brought unto him many that were possessed with demons. Now, I have had occasion to see some of that type of thing up close. As a matter of fact, I remember my own father on one occasion telling me that a man who was very powerful and was the treasurer of his organization was demon-possessed. And I said, well, Dad, the Bible commands us to cast them out, not keep them around like a house pet. That's exactly what I said, quote, unquote, at that time. I won't go into that, but Jesus, it said, cast out the spirits with his word. Because, you see, he had compassion on the individual who was possessed, not fear of the demon in the individual, which oftentimes is the motivating emotion on the part of an awful lot of people, even in the ministry, who come across someone who is demon-possessed, because they don't have sufficient faith or trust in Jesus Christ, who is billions of times more powerful than that demon. And that demon fears Jesus Christ and cannot stand in front of his name or his powerful spiritual presence. So if a man is imbued with fear instead of faith, he will dodge the responsibility of casting out a demon. Christ did not, because he had compassion. He cast out the spirits with his word and healed all that were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. And there are many other scriptures I could quote to you, I won't repeat them time and again, that say that Jesus Christ had compassion on those who came to him. In Matthew 19 and verse 16, if you'll turn to that, we're familiar with a young man who had all the world's goods, who came and said, "Good master, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?" And he said unto him, "Why do you call me good? There is none good but God. But if you will enter into life, keep the commandments." This is not blind obedience to a harsh and a rigorous set of laws. It is instead the building of character and the instilling in a human mind of those values we saw in 1 Corinthians 13 of long-suffering, of faith, of patience, of mercy, of goodness and decency, of kindness and generosity, of all of those qualities of Jesus Christ himself. This young man said, Which commandments do you mean? Jesus said, "You shall do no murder," but we saw that he magnified that in the Sermon on the Mount, meaning you can't even hate anyone. "You shall not commit adultery," and we saw that he magnified that in the Sermon on the Mount, you cannot even lust after someone. "You shall not steal." "You shall not bear false witness." "You don't lie." "Honor your father and your mother." And "You shall love your neighbor with a love that is so full and so enormous, it is a love which does nothing but care for itself, be concerned for itself, worry about itself, provide for itself, feed and clothe itself, make itself comfortable." I refer to self-love. Because the greatest love we can lavish on someone else is the kind of love we lavish on ourselves. God does not require that we love our neighbor more than ourselves, because any one of us who would love a neighbor as we love ourselves is showering enormous love on our neighbor. The young man said, "All these things have I kept from my youth up." Why do I doubt that statement? It says the young man said it. I don't think that means that absolutely, perfectly, and flawlessly he did it, but he said it. "What lack I yet?" Jesus offered him a discipleship. He said, "All right, if you will be perfect, go and sell that you have and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure where it really counts, not in a Swiss bank account, but in heaven. And come and follow me." The young man could have said, "I'll do it." And he could have helped enormously suffering, poverty-stricken, disease-ridden, wretched people, and could have been one of Christ's own disciples. Instead, he went away sorrowful, sadly shaking his head. That's asking too much. We are put on this earth, Jesus Christ of Nazareth tells us, to summarize what our obligations really are, to build character. The dictionary says that character is all qualities or features possessed, kind, sort, or nature, moral strengths or weaknesses, a special way in which a person thinks, feels, or acts. But we're not just to build character, because you can be any kind of a character, but to build godly character, the character of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. What do you think of this kind of character? There are people in this world today, and I include the entire populace of Iraq, with the exception of a few here and there that are probably absolutely terrified. And I cite the fact that over 50% of the population of that country are employed by the government when you include the army and the reserves. And about 30% of the population is employed full or part-time in keeping track of and spying, just like the Russian and the East German systems, on others. I have told you of cases where people's private bedrooms were bugged and wired for sound. Here is a people who have an outlet for their passions in one direction only, and that is through their total submission to their leader. The word Islam means submission, to submit. That there will be future despots and leaders, strong men, to move into this vacuum when Gotr Damerung has been played to its fullest, last, huge ecological sigh of resignation, I do not doubt. Out of all of this will emerge, no doubt, the fabled King of the South, or the notorious King of the South of Daniel 11, 40-45. and we will see new Arab despots emerge. But as we look at what we're supposed to do, when we look at a young man who was told to forsake all and follow Jesus Christ, and to learn how to be an overcomer, to learn personal responsibility, personal choice, to learn my definition of character, which is to be able to discern the difference between right and wrong, and to have the willpower to force yourself to choose the right. This little boy, this chicken stealer, who became a jackal and an absolute insult to all of humanity, and even an environmental terrorist, is probably one of the most miserable human beings on the earth today, cowering in fear, who knows his life is over. And like those of whom we read, the beast and the false prophet of biblical prophecy at the time of the second coming of Christ, God would judge, here is a man who needs to be put to death about as badly as any human being who's ever walked this earth. But he was produced by a factory over in Iraq that was known as the home of his stepfather and his mother. They made him, and they shaped him, and they formed him. And those people over there whose lives need to be regulated by this charismatic, this wonderful man smiling down on them with his generosity and his charm, are following this charming dictator with a rewritten history, with a false genealogy all the way to Muhammad the Prophet, who is nothing but a chicken-stealing coward with blood and murder and torture on his hands. Thank God that Jesus Christ of Nazareth has made me part of a church that will have nothing to do with dictators, a church that has checks and balances, a church that encourages its membership to make unilateral decisions based upon the facts, a church that is told continually, don't believe me, believe the Bible, a church that has a board of trustees, that has committees and a ministerial council that are set up in such a way that one man can never gain power over the church and abuse that power or the money of the church or its people. Because believe it or not, hiding out in the pulpits of our good land are dictators.